Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. So, this show is a little special. For the first time ever, we are featuring all repeat storytellers.
The rule had always been that you could only tell an Arctic Entry story once.
But to celebrate 7 years and nearly 400 stories, we decided to break the rules and bring back some of your favorite storytellers from years past. The title for these shows was The 7-Year Itch, Arctic Entries Through the Years, featuring past storytellers telling new stories.
We'll start with Erica Madison, who originally told a story way back in season 2.
So I have a confession to make. I like to call myself a real do-it-yourself kind of girl, someone who wants to do everything by herself, fixer-upper type. I'm the type of girl who can change her brake fluid while baking an apple pie and remodeling the bathroom. But here's what actually happens. I turn on some Journey, and I put the pie in the oven, and I call my dad. My dad is the real deal. He can fix anything. I don't think I ever saw him out of his coveralls as a child unless he was flying a jet or at church. He's the type of guy who, on our family vacations, would be sitting under an umbrella wearing his 1970s white tennis shorts, reading his Chilton's Automotive Manual. I hated these manuals as a child. I just have memories of sitting on a greasy garage bench and him telling me to read the step-by-step instructions for the 1970s Saab that he was working on. Step 44E, unscrew the four screws from the casing of the water pump, pull the hose out and drain into a basin. Step 44F, snack. Dad, I think we should get a snack. I think this is the time we should get a snack. This is the time when the daughter helping father scenario, I would get the light duty. Anybody who has a parent who fixes things or works on things knows what this means. You get to hold the light. And that consists of, Erica, pay attention to the left. Do you not see what I'm working on? To the left? I just wanted to go outside and play, but that sob was kind of my jungle gym. Over time, I got better in the garage. Like, I totally know what a crescent wrench is now. But honestly, every single do-it-yourself fixer-upper project I've ever worked on is a success because of my father. For instance, one time I came home and my water heater had this beautiful waterfall coming out of the top of it, flooding a river into the kitchen. And I called my dad and he came running over, you know, immediately. And I stuck around just long enough to figure out what soldering meant, and then I went for a run. It's not just me, though. Everyone calls my dad, and I just want to explain, like, sometimes my mom has to answer the phone and say my dad's not home because everybody needs help from my dad. Probably 20% of you in the audience right now have had help from my dad, whether you know it or not. Like, if you were on the side of Minnesota with your hood up, he was the one who stopped and fixed your car. Over the past several years, I've kind of noticed this change in my dad. Like, he had a slight limp, and when he was giving me these very step-by-step instructions, he started to stutter. And then there was this tremor in his right arm. And what happened is my dad was diagnosed with Parkinson's. Briefly described, Parkinson's affects the brain, and it affects how your body moves. So think of it like this. Your brain is a Chilton's manual giving you all these instructions on what to do. Parkinson's messes all of that up and mixes up the instructions, so your body can't move when you want it to. For someone who is the best fixer-upper in the world, it doesn't work anymore. My selfish biggest fear about my dad having Parkinson's is that he's not going to be my saving grace and fix everything for me. This year, I needed to paint the laundry room. Easy enough, brown paint on the walls, white paint on the ceiling. So I started to cut in the brown, and I realized I don't actually know how to cut in a wall. And all of a sudden, the ceiling turned brown with smudges. So I wiped it off with a rag, and I called my dad and asked him over for dinner. He came over in his coveralls. His hand was shaking so bad when he dipped the paintbrush into the paint that paint flicked all over the floor. When he crawled up the ladder, he was so unstable and hunched over. And as he got up to the corner of the wall, he all of a sudden, the Parkinson's just disappeared. And that slow, methodical thought came back, and he cut this perfect straight line across the laundry room ceiling. All I could say was, Dad, I'll go get the light from the garage. It's not very often I'm away from my dad via cell phone or sat phone or Delorme or anything I can use to get a hold of my dad. But there was this one time when I was in Chile, and I was on a ski trip, and I flew into Bamaseda to meet my girlfriend, and she picked me up with her niece in her Gaucho's brand new white Toyota truck. And I just need to set the stage for you. This truck was shipped from the US. Each part of it was hand-picked by this Gaucho. If you thought Gauchos loved their horses, you should see them with their trucks. So we're driving this truck up a 3,000-foot pass to get to the skier area, and a blizzard comes in. And Rachel needs to pull the truck over to put it into four-wheel drive. As she pulls over and pushes the truck into four-wheel drive, the entire knob comes out in her hand. She turns white because she's scared of the Gaucho. I turn white because I'm freaked out that we need to get over this 3,000-foot pass. Her niece turns white because she was car sick and she just starts puking everywhere. So we have snow coming in the car, a puking niece, and all I want is my dad to fix this problem, and instead I'm handed a Leatherman. So Rachel and I pull the carpet off the center console, and I just instinctively start unscrewing every single screw I can find. And I pull off the plastic console, and there is the ground and the transfer case. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. So I take the pliers and I pull apart the place I think that the shifty knobby thing should go. And I'm jamming it in, and Rachel's pushing the truck back and forth into neutral. And then I hear this click, and the truck goes into four-wheel drive. And Rachel and I just start screaming because we just saved this Toyota Tundra for the Gaucho. But really, what I realized is I kind of can do things by myself, and maybe at some point I'll work on things and my dad can hold the light. Thank you.
That was Erica Madison, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute true stories about their lives. Our theme for this show is Arctic Entries Through the Years.
Like Bob Dylan, our next storyteller grew up in northern Minnesota and mumbles. His daughter describes him as a cross between Indiana Jones and Red Green.
Here's Merlin Hamry on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
Sitting behind a table on a raised platform is this elegant appearing but authoritative officer. To his right is an armed guard, and to either side of them are sitting three other people in chairs in a line straight across the room. I'm sitting across the room by myself, being the accused in front of this tribunal. How did I get there? I had a project in Ghana, West Africa, and that found me one day driving my motorcycle to the city of Hohoi. There, I pulled up to the Standard Bank. At this time, I had made arrangements with my friend Don, who had married a Ghanaian, to stay with his sister-in-law. Needing directions to her house, I approached the guard at the bank. I gave him the letter that Don sent me with her address on it, folded back so only the address would appear, and asked the guard in front of the bank about directions. Seeing the address, he grabbed the letter from me, opened it up, starting reading it intently. I protested, but I abruptly seized that, doing that when I found myself looking down the barrel of his gun. He proceeded to read the letter and then alluded to what he would do if I tried to escape, and he escorted me down to the police station. At the police station, he had discussions with the police officers. Then he came up to me and stated that I needed to stay there, and he disappeared. The police officers were looking at each other, and they seemed perplexed. They didn't really look like they knew what they needed to do with me, so they directed me to this backless bench behind the police counter. Subsequently, someone came and escorted me in front of the tribunal. At this time, the guard, who was from the bank, proceeded to accuse me of being a spy and had seen me previously in Hohoi. I can't remember much of the discussion after that, but I do remember my friend with the gun. As the things were slow progressing, the gun slowly rose, and it was till it was pointed right at my head. The officer who was sitting at the raised platform then gracefully reached out his hand, put his hand on the rifle, and lowered it so it was pointing at the floor. The third time that happened, the officer changed his mantra a bit, and as he was putting his hand on the rifle, looked at the guard and put the rifle so it's pointed at the ground again. The gun wasn't pointed at me again. Afterwards, they had decided that they needed to make further inquiries, and since it was Friday, that those inquiries couldn't be made until Monday. So I was taken back to the police station. The police, you know, really weren't sure what to do with me, so I got to go and sit back on my bench. Subsequently, a woman comes into the police station, starts talking with the police officers. She is later joined by a more elderly gentleman. And after their discussion at the police desk, they come up and talk to me, and stating that this was my friend's sister-in-law and this was her uncle who had posted bail for me. Now, as we're headed to her place, I made the discovery that certain people in similar circumstances to myself behave differently. You see, in the past, when my romantic overtures were rejected, I just moped. You see, the guard at the bank, when his overtures were rejected by my friend's sister-in-law, he had a whole different tact on the situation. Now, because of the ridiculousness of my situation there, that weekend was spent by me having repeated assurances that everything was going to be all right. But then Sunday afternoon came, and someone came to their home and said, I had to go back to the police station. I was given back my bench, trying to sleep on it, and then I was awoken by this commotion just to see a prisoner in his birthday suit making a break for it with three police officers running after him. Shortly thereafterwards, the same individual came back accompanied by the same three police officers. And trying to doze off, then I was wakened by this sound that went shclack, shclack, followed by yelps of pain. The following morning, I'm back to sitting on my bench and being repeatedly assured by the police officers that everything's going to be all right. And someone comes into the police station and says, I have to go into a cell. In the cell, I could see black smudges going around the cell where people had been leaning against the wall. And above that, there were specks, which upon closer inspection showed that they were blood. Finally, someone came, and I was taken into an office with two detectives who were very friendly, and they put a statement in front of me. The statement basically read like, I was invited down to the police station for tea and crumpets. There was a misunderstanding, but now everything was all right. I signed it. My rest of the time in Hawaii, I was greeted fondly by police officers across the city. The detectives gave me a ride when they saw me walking someplace. But a week later, I was sitting in a chair and shaking uncontrollably. Thank you.
That was Merlin Hamry. If you want to hear his first Arctic Entries story, check the Season 4 archive at arcticentries.com. But for right now, you should keep listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. We're hearing true stories told by Alaskans.
Linda Lucky is a retired art teacher and artist from New York. She works in a variety of mediums and is best known for her playful papier-mâché dogs, which make an appearance in this story.
I have long since finished parenting. It was a great gig. But now, in this phase of my life, I cherish my freedom and my independence. I don't mind sharing my space sometimes because I'm a very social person. However, at the end of the day, I want nothing alive waiting for me on the other side of that door when I come home. Nothing that needs feeding, walking, or watering. That covers all people, plants, and pets. I think dogs are very high maintenance. I love dogs, but other people's. Then I can give them back. Like grandchildren, you borrow them, you give them back. But not to own one. It's too much work. Also, dogs are in my art. I make papier-mâché dogs, and people see them, and they say, oh, you must have a dog. And I say, no way. I am not prepared to walk behind a dog and pick up its poop. My daughter, Lee, went somewhere for this dog. She got herself a silky one-year-old terrier. It already had been turned away from two families for its excessive barking. I already don't like this dog. It's manic. It has no social skills. It has a high-pitched yelp. And he figured a way to trick the bark collar so that it lowers its decibel just in the no-zap zone. At least it was neutered, so there was no leg humping. when my family said, you know, we might move out of state in 4 years. We'll give the dog to you. I said, that dog has 4 years to live. The dog and my family are in my neighborhood. So I decide that I'm going to go over there, and it's easy to give it walks. I decide that I start to see the dog's finer qualities, like it's cute. And it's crazy for me. It's so wildly enthusiastic as it rushes to the door to just greet me. I said, when was the last time a guy left skid marks to get to me? I want to know this dog better. Now, sleepovers are, they're going to require some boundaries. Considering what Teddy and I were becoming to each other, I knew he expected to be in my bed. So I decided he's going to need some restraints if he's going to win that prize. The first time, I let him sleep in my room, but I put the bed on a wingback chair across from me so he can see me at eye level. He looks, he'd like to be closer, but he gives up and falls asleep. The second time, I am compromising. I put his bed on my bed. This he cannot understand. He steps into his bed, he turns around, and he lets go with this high-pitched whine. I pretend not to notice as I'm laying there pretending to read my book. The third time, my resistance is gone. I drift to sleep with the feel of a soft, furry little body cuddled next to me. Mind you, he's not moving in. This is just an affair. It's nothing more than that. Then comes the day, the dreaded call. Mom, we have to talk. I said, I don't want a dog. I knew. She insisted I come over. They can't keep Teddy. I listen. They say, you're the one, the obvious one, who can take the dog. I balk at this. I say, put him on Craigslist. Take him to the pound. My grandchildren are horrified. Nana, if you don't take him, he'll die. Now, I know, silently, I'm going to take him. However, I want to see how long I can keep up this resistance. I finally yield to the inevitable. I take the leash, and that night, I walk Teddy home for the first time to my house as my dog. I am his human, he is my dog. And I'm thinking, I'm his fourth owner. I'm like New York. If he can't make it here, he can't make it anywhere. A friend of mine said, how do you know this is going to work? I said, 4 years of foreplay. So the first order of business, I take him to the spa at the vet's. He gets the treatment. Shampoo, nail trim, butt shave, teeth brushed. If he's going to sleep with me, he's got to be bed ready. I start to think about all this unconditional love that people talk about you get from a dog, right? What is that? How do you test that? And then I remembered I saw something. Put your dog and your spouse in the trunk of your car. Come back in an hour. Who is really happy to see you? Teddy and has a pretty cushy life with me. He's got 3 doggy beds in the house where I usually hang out. Plus, he's got my bed. And then in my big fenced yard, he can run like the wind. And then there's even a dog park in the corner of the yard, complete with lights, sculptures. I finally have a real dog that can play in there. Teddy and I have been together now for almost a year. We're learning to, we're adjusting to each other's needs and personalities. He has become much more mellow, and I am learning to be a pack leader, although sometimes I wonder who is leading whom. Oh, this is so good. I have a great ending for you. I just told him. Okay. Oh, this is good. I look at him across the room, and I say to myself, wow, I really have a dog. And then I know it's true, because in the pockets of every outer coat, raincoat, vest, and bathrobe are orange plastic poopy bags. And I know every morning what I see, two furry ears near my pillow. It looks like there is something really, something on the other side of that door when I get home, something that needs my full attention. Oh, Teddy, what a good boy you are. Thank
you. You just heard from Linda Lucky, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Lucky has been a docent at the Anchorage Museum for 13 years.
Maybe you'll recognize her voice next time you visit. Our next storyteller has been a professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage for 17 years. He's very well respected in his field and has been a visiting lecturer at universities and institutions in the U.S. and even internationally. Here's Paul Ontuguk.
Just to start it out on a happy note, when I was 10, my mom died. Seriously, it happened. And my dad, who had been this great guy, turned into a hopeless alcoholic and sometimes just a mean drunk. So we ended up in foster care, four boys. And I got to figure out, well, what are foster parents? There are categories that I came up with in my mind. And one of the first ones were missionaries. These are people who see foster care as an opportunity to just convert you, and they've got a 24/7 on you in order to do that. Now, I already had a disappointing view of God, given the prior circumstances. He'd gone from being Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny to being kind of a mean drunk himself, from what I can figure. And so now he's got these people who are doing emotional, physical blackmail on trying to convert you, so I would have nothing to do with it. Another category that we had, though, were they're almost impossible to see. In fact, we called them unicorns. And these are foster parents who were just decent human beings that in a chaotic, tough life, they just wanted to give you a 30-day window of what it meant to be treated decently as a human being. They were called unicorns for a reason. There weren't a lot of them. The last group that I want to mention are mercenaries. These are people who figured out that if you converted your garage with bunk beds into holding 4 to 6 foster kids, and you fed us cereal in the morning, school lunch in the afternoon, and then hot dogs or mac and cheese for dinner, that they could do all right. This could be an ongoing business opportunity. Those were tough. Those are tough, because what happened was, when you get kids like that in that kind of chaotic circumstance, some of them become victims. They just have given up on themselves. And so you can beat them, you can hit them, you can do whatever, and they just, at most, they just cry. They scream, but they don't defend themselves. The other part were the predators. The kids normally would form up into packs. I got to experience being a loner, not one or the other, and so I got beat up a lot, to be honest about it. It's not like the movies. You don't win. So what I did is I came up with a plan that any time a guy came in for me, the first one in the pack, I would aim to give him permanent physical damage. And the goal was that they would never want to come back and repeat the experience. And it kind of worked. But it's an escalator that goes up and down, that violence, and it just doesn't get any better. And at one point, we sort of maxed out. We're at a movie, in behind a movie, an old movie house, in an alley, and this guy, one of the guys, is swinging a lead pipe at me. Serious. And as he swung once, he's like this to me. And I've got a knife. And from his armpit down, it's like open season. It's like, what a gift. And at the last moment, rather than sticking him under his armpit, I decided to just stick him in the leg, which is kind of like being Gandhi in these circumstances. And so the guy drops a pipe. His older brother and friends run off and abandon him. And it was like a John Wayne movie. We took off his belt. We cinched it up. We took something, I think a sock, and stuffed it in the hole. And the police are coming. You can hear them. And the guy says, you got to get out of here. I had just stabbed him. Pretty considerate. I took off. He held to the story that he fell on a bottle and he never ratted me out. Admire him to this day. But overall, my view of God is not enhanced by any of this experience, because now I'm figuring he's malicious as well. But while I'm in this thing, this girl was at school and she was very nice, and I talked to her and she was had a Bible and she started talking to me more and more, and one thing led to another. And I was realizing she might be God's ambassador saying, can we have a truce? Can we do a do-over? Can we start over again? And so I went for it. I went for it so hard and long that I have a degree in religion and philosophy. Highly marketable, by the way. So I took a second one in history. I get my teaching certificate, return to Northwest Alaska. I'm married, we're contributing to the community, and what happens is my wife, the pregnancy goes wrong, and we end up being medevaced down to Anchorage from Kotzebue, and we're at Providence. It goes so wrong that our daughter, Nicole Elizabeth, isn't going to live very long. And my wife at the time is completely under. So solo, in a small room, I got to hold her until she passed away. And she's now buried at Anchorage Cemetery. What do you do with that? Well, what I know for a fact in my experience is it doesn't get better. Time does not heal. None of this gets any easier. And for a long time, I figured not only was he a sociopath, but he was a vicious one for doing this kind of a thing. It's right when I started to have some trust, it was shattered beyond ever repair. And that held me pretty much for years. But over time, what I've done is I put it all in a box. The rage, the hatred, the confusion, whether or not he exists, hoping that he doesn't at times, that's in one box. And then the other box, the rest of it has to be my life. Because if I'm ever going to contribute to the community again, I can't stay with the box. I just have to remember the better parts of that prior experience and try to be kind, sort of to make up for everything that I'd done before. There is no good thing about this. You get stories where some people are role models. I'm a gargoyle. I'm the warning sign about how to do life. The only thing I can say about where I am now is that I'm a mess, but I'm trying not to be a waste. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul Antigo. This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. And our show is a little different this month because we're featuring repeat storytellers. This means we gave past storytellers a chance to come back to the stage to tell another, different, true story about themselves. You can find all of the storytellers' previous stories in our archives at arcticentries.com.
Now we'll hear from someone who really enjoys sharing stories. He's a lawyer, a college professor, and he's my co-host. Yes, Jason Brandeis is one of our storytellers this month.
The year was 1984. I was 8 years old, and life was great. I had just successfully completed the third grade, where I learned all sorts of new and interesting things, like how to write in cursive and how to do multiplication. I had a really active social life. I had a bunch of friends that all lived in the neighborhood, and we would get together and play every day after school. And in the summertime, we never missed an opportunity to ride our bikes around, to go out and play baseball, or to sometimes just spend a whole afternoon watching cartoons. It was a pretty idyllic childhood. So I didn't take it too well when my parents told me that we were moving. Now, by most objective measurements, the move was a big upgrade. My family was leaving the urban confines of Brooklyn, New York, and heading to a much cleaner, safer, and quieter suburban enclave in New Jersey. Our new home was bigger. There was a backyard with a swimming pool. We even had cable television for the first time. Our town had acres and acres of untamed woods that I could run around and explore. Even my new school had a more inviting and friendlier name. I had been attending New York City Public School number 272. My new school was named after the babbling brook that ran alongside it. But these objective measurements, these objective upgrades, they didn't matter much to an emotional 8-year-old. I was sad, I was lonely. I was having a hard time making friends, and I missed my old friends. Making things worse, the first day of school was getting closer and closer. I was terrified about starting at a new school where I didn't know anyone, about having to do things that I had never done before, like get on a school bus. I was nervous and I was anxious. My parents recognized this, and they tried to do what they could. They wound up doing what most parents in the 1980s did when their kids were struggling. They went shopping. What my parents came up with, though, the plan was actually quite clever. There was an article of clothing that I had really wanted for a really long time. My parents decided to buy it for me. They gave it to me and told me that this was something special for me to wear on the first day of school. The idea was that this garment would be something positive that I could focus on. It would replace the negative feelings, the anxiety and the stress that I was feeling about the first day. And it totally worked. I loved my new Michael Jackson jacket. And let me be clear so you know what I'm talking about. This was a replica of the jacket that Michael Jackson wore in the Thriller video. It was a red jacket that had like a black V across the front of it, not to be confused with the Billie Jean jacket that had a lot of shiny sequins all over it. And it was definitely not the Beat It video jacket that was also red but had a lot of like zippers and chainmail on it for some reason. This was the Thriller jacket, and to an 8-year-old kid who was obsessed with Michael Jackson, that was about as cool as it got. There was one catch, though. I wasn't allowed to wear it out until that first day. So I wore it around the house, and I practiced. I would gather my school supplies, everything from that carefully curated list of the exact number of pens and pencils and glue sticks and markers and notebooks and pads and rulers and protractors and everything you were going to need for the school year. I'd put it all in my backpack, I'd put the jacket on, and I'd wander around the house practicing. When the first day of school came, I was ready. Jacket on, backpack slung over my shoulder. I left the house with my mom, and she escorted me down the street to the school bus stop. Now, I had never been on a school bus before, but I understood the basics. You get on the bus, you find a seat, and it takes you to school. The bus arrived, I got on it, but all of a sudden, something was seriously wrong. I started walking down the aisle, and I realized there were no seats. There was no space. No one was moving over and making room for me. I didn't know what to do. My heart started to beat really fast. My breathing got shallow. My neck got hot. My face got red. I felt alone and adrift without a place to sit. And then I heard it coming from the back of the bus. From the back of the bus were the older kids, the 12-year-olds, the cool kids, where they sat. "Hey, Michael. Why don't you moonwalk for us, Michael? Where's your white glove, Michael?" Oh no, everything was spinning. I didn't know what to do. What was happening? Were they making fun of me and my sweet Michael Jackson jacket? Is it possible that Michael Jackson is not as cool in this part of the world as he was in Brooklyn, New York? The panic was getting worse. I didn't know what to do. And suddenly there was a glimmer of hope. I thought, what would Michael Jackson do? So I calmly stared straight ahead. I dropped my arms to my side. I started sliding backwards, and I moonwalked off the bus. Oh, how I wish that was true. I wish that I had moonwalked off the bus, but I was only 8 years old. I didn't know what a dramatic exit was at that point. What I actually did is what any reasonable 8-year-old would do under the circumstances. I turned around and ran right off the bus, much to the surprise of the bus driver and my mother, who was not expecting to see me again so soon. "What are you doing?" she asked. "I'm not going," I said. "What do you mean you're not going?" "There are no seats. I'm not going." And what I meant was, I'm not going to school ever again. In my mind, the social contract had been violated. There were no seats. I was retiring from academia. That simple. Fortunately, I had a really great mom, and she said, "Oh no, you're going. Come on, I'll find you a seat." She grabbed my hand and pulled me back up onto the bus. Yeah, as an 8-year-old kid who had just gotten laughed off the school bus, pretty much the best thing that could happen would be to have your mom get back on the bus and try to find a seat for you. And find me a seat she did. She marched down the aisle and started moving people around. "You, get up. You, slide over. Make some space. My son needs to go to school." She plopped me down in the seat, kissed me on the head, and said, "Have a great first day of school, honey." Little did my mom realize that she had sat me down right with the very kids that were making fun of me. And for the rest of that ride to school, they came up with every creative and colorful way they could to make fun of me, my mom, and Michael Jackson. And I just had to sit there and take it, wrapped in my faux red leather blanket of shame. When we finally got to school, I got off the bus as quickly as I could. I hustled down the hallway. I found my classroom. I made it to my desk. I tore my jacket off, and I stuffed it in the back of my desk. I promised myself that I would never wear it again. I took a deep breath and felt relaxed for the first time in what seemed like hours. I looked around my classroom. I saw my classmates. They were talking with one another. They were saying hello. They were laughing. No one was staring at me. No one was making fun of me. No one was even looking at me. I felt safe. I felt secure. I knew I could start over. I wasn't going to be the weird Michael Jackson jacket kid. So I looked down, ready to start my day. I unzipped my backpack to start taking my things out. And then all of a sudden, the panic from the bus returned. My chest got tight, my throat got dry, my face got hot and red, because staring back up at me from my backpack were all of my Michael Jackson-themed school supplies. Yeah. My Michael Jackson notebook, my Michael Jackson homework pad, and my Michael Jackson trapper keeper. This ordeal was far from over. Thank you.
That was a story told by Arctic Entries Radio Hour host Jason Brandeis. Take a look at the Arctic Entries Facebook page to see Jason in some of his MJ attire.
I never should have showed you that picture.
Too late. Next, we'll hear from screenwriter and novelist Don Reardon.
So I'm your average tough guy Alaskan, not really afraid of anything except snakes, scorpions, taxes. Just kidding about the snakes. I'm in Southwest Alaska. Buddies dropped me off in the middle of nowhere, or a couple of miles past there, a lake, glacier-fed lake. I've got everything a tough Alaskan guy needs to survive. A gun, sleeping bag, a tent, a couple coolers of food, and a really sweet dry bag with my emergency supplies in it. I set up camp. My buddy takes off in his float plane. It's the only way to get there. I'm the only guy for a long ways around, which feels good when you're a tough Alaskan. Not afraid of anything. I'm up on the hillside eating berries, and I decide that that's dinner. Blueberries, because I'm tough. Not afraid of the giant chocolate brown bear across the way eating the same berries. And it starts to get windy, starts to get a little stormy. The bear heads into the brush. I figure that's probably my cue to go to my tent. I have to talk about my tent here for a moment, because it wasn't actually my tent. It was my buddy's tent. It was a very expensive bomb shelter of a tent. An Alaskan weather port, pretty much like the coolest tent you can get, like $2,000 rubberized steel frame. This thing can withstand 90-mile-an-hour winds. So I got everything I need. The storm's picking up. It's getting worse, but man, no worries. I go to sleep. Right before I go to sleep, I have this strange thought of, as the storm's really starting to pick up, like, man, if I didn't have this tent right now, I'd be in trouble. Now, the weather port is an interesting kind of tent because it doesn't have a floor. It's kind of like, it looks like if you cut a pop can in half, like a Quonset hut. And so I laid a tarp down and put my sleeping bag. I go to sleep. A couple hours later, I hear a roar. It's not a bear. It's not Sarah Palin. I think, my buddy must be coming back. And so which is weird. I checked my watch, it's 10:15. Like, he wouldn't be coming middle of August. Like, no one would risk coming in the mountains, like, in float plane. Must just be a jet going overhead. Those are kind of my thoughts as I drift back to sleep. And then I hear, boof, and all of a sudden I can see. And I'm looking out at the lake, this glacier-fed lake, and is a sea of confused waves, and I can see. The tent was pitch black. And there's my tent in the air, 40 feet in the air, sailing towards the lake. And it hits the water, and I have this my first thought is like, I gotta get it. Now, that would have been one of those classic Alaskan mysteries. The tent hits the water, and it sinks. And this is what I said. Oh, I'm gonna die. I actually said that. There was nobody there to hear it. Because the next blast of wind and rain that was hitting so hard started to roll all my stuff. Now, I forgot to tell you that it was the one time I decided not to sleep naked, which is weird. I was fully clothed, and my sleeping bag goes flying off towards the lake, and I'm running, and I'm grabbing and scrambling to get anything that I can as the wind is rolling my coolers across the tundra towards the water. And all I could do was make basically what I would call your classic Alaskan tarp coffin. I just wrapped myself in this tarp, and I laid there. Absolutely soaking wet and freezing to death. Fast forward several hours of freezing to death. It's morning. All I can do is just lay there because it was dark. And so as soon as there was enough daylight for me to get up, I got up. I was at this point. Now, I know some of you know all the stages of hypothermia. There's a few things that people don't tell you about hypothermia. And one is you start shaking really bad, and then you start to cramp up, and your jaws are chattering so hard that you're biting your tongue and your lips. That doesn't feel good. And then if you remember those movies like from the 80s where they were teaching you about hypothermia, one of the things they teach you about is that you could start to, and I knew all these stages, so I was really paranoid about them. One of the stages is you'll start to hallucinate. And in that classic movie, one of the hallucinations is Abraham Lincoln appears. You do not want Abraham Lincoln to appear if you're in the middle of the Alaskan wilderness. And this whole time, I'm super paranoid, and I'm worried about this tent because I'm not going to get it back. I'm going to have to explain to my buddy that it's gone. And at the same time, I'm freezing to death. And I'm remembering the classic words Anthony Hopkins said in the movie The Edge, which don't ever watch it. He tells one of the Baldwin brothers, people die of shame in the wilderness. This is how they die. And I'm so ashamed I've lost this tent. But I'm freezing to death. My fingers won't work. I'm trying to start a fire. I'm trying everything that I know to start a fire. Everything. My fingers are little blocks. I'm cramping up. There's nothing that I can do. And I'm so, so paranoid about the tent. And finally, I go over to this beaver lodge around the way. I pull out some sticks. I dig down to try to get something dry. And I'm shaving down to the middle of them. I'm trying everything, every trick I have in the book. And finally, at some point, I don't know what happened. I was waiting for Abraham Lincoln, I guess. And I'm just burning paper towel after paper towel, and all of a sudden I have a fire. All of a sudden there's hope. It's like hope that maybe I'm going to make it, you know? And I get this fire going. I strip down. I'm totally naked, trying to dry my clothes. I'm like, okay, I'm going to make it. But I'm still not sure. I'm really scared. And then the berries kick in. So I have to leave my only little pile of brush to go to this other little pile of brush and to relieve myself. And then the relief hits. As I'm relieving myself, I look over, and there about 2 feet from me is an axe and a gallon of Coleman fuel that somebody had left years prior. But I was suddenly the tough Alaskan again, you know? I forgot to tell you, in my survival bag, when I opened that up, it was my Alaskan survival bag, apparently, because it had a tank top and some swim trunks and some condoms, because I was really screwed. But I had a fire, and I had hope, and you know what? I didn't even need to pick up that gallon of Coleman fuel or the axe, because I knew I was going to be okay. But I was still worried what I was going to tell my buddy about the tent. So when he pulled back in his float plane and he said, ask the obvious question, where's the tent? All I could do was point. Thank you.
That was Don Reardon, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our final storyteller for this show is Issa Brayman. Issa has six siblings and believes that her love for storytelling is rooted in family dinners, where each person yelled louder and louder and with more charisma in order to try to capture the attention of their parents.
Here she is for the second time at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
I remember my first week of work, I walked into a staff meeting that we usually have, and I sat down in my chair and I looked around the room and I realized something very important. I realized, one, that I was one of the only people in that room that was born and raised in the United States, and two, that I was probably one of the only people in the room that didn't speak another language fluently. You see, I have the blessing and the honor of working with people that are mostly refugees and immigrants from all over the world, and my coworkers are some of the funniest and most charming people you have ever met. We have the best potlucks in the entire city, I absolutely guarantee it. And we always have these funny kind of diversity things that are happening in our office all the time. Our office is like a modern-day Tower of Babel. It's very confusing all the time, and there's 100 different languages going on. I walked into an office meeting once with a really terrible cough, and my coworker from Bhutan said, "Issa, do you have a cough? Well, you need to drink warm milk with honey," which was soon followed by my coworker from Mexico, who pulled out a bag out of her purse and said, "You need to drink this tea. My mom sent it from Mexico. Don't take a drug test anytime soon." Followed by my Somali coworker, who then says to me, "You need to drink tea with a bunch of sugar in it. It will coat your throat and make you feel better." My two Russian coworkers walk and say, "They're all wrong. What you need to do is take a glass of vodka. Wait a second, you're an American. Take a shot of vodka. Put a bunch of pepper in it. Drink that. It'll make you cough so much you'll feel better in any moment." That was followed by my program director saying, "Why don't you try all those things when you go home from work today?" And so I just have this great honor and privilege of working with people all over the world and refugees that come to the United States, teaching them culture orientation, which is basically America 101. Here's everything you need to know to survive and do well in our new country. And in my first 3 months of work, I was on a webinar with cultural orientation advisors from all over the world. So people that are teaching CO domestically within the United States, people that are teaching cultural orientation in Africa and Southeast Asia and the Middle East and South America. And they're giving us information about what refugees are being told before they arrive to U.S. soil. And at the end of it, there was some question and answer time, and somebody asked the question, "What's the most common question you get asked in overseas orientation? What's the most pressing thing that refugees want to know about?" And I'll never forget the answer to that question, which was this. The most important thing refugees want to know is, "What do I do if I meet a gay person?" Now, before we all think, why would that even matter, we have to understand that refugees are coming from countries where this homosexuality is still an illegal act. Where if you're homosexual, it's likely that you could incur beatings, you could be put into prison, you could actually face death. That for them, this is a taboo topic. This is something we don't talk about in their culture, in their religions, and a lot of times in their countries or in their lives. And for them, this is an actual real question. What do I do if I meet a gay person? And for me, this question also mattered because I had moved to Alaska with my girlfriend. I had been working in my job for 3 months. And I heard that question, and I made a decision right then and there. I made the decision that what I was going to do is I was going to do my job. I was going to work at my job. I was going to be an advocate outside of my job, and at my job, I was going to do my job. That my sexual orientation didn't belong in a classroom, because what would they do if they met a gay person? And so the world around me happens. I'm in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm working on non-discrimination ordinance policies. In 2012, we're trying to pass a non-discrimination ordinance in the municipality. I'm on the volunteer task force for that. I'm going to Lisa Murkowski's office trying to ask her to pass a non-discrimination ordinance. I volunteer at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center. You know, I get engaged to the woman that I moved to Alaska with. And while all these things are happening around me, I'm going to my office. And I'm not lying. I'm not telling my coworkers who I am. I'm just avoiding talking about it. You see, that same question that was asked by the refugees, "What do I do if I meet a gay person?" I didn't know what my coworkers would say to me. And so I made this decision to live in two worlds. I lived in a world where I would go to work and do my job, and I would walk out of work and be an advocate for myself and for my community. And in June of 2013, it's the first time that we're talking about marriage equality on the national level. The Supreme Court's going to take the DOMA case, the Defense of Marriage Act. Is the marriage defined between a man or a woman or not? Edie wins or sues, and it gets up to the Supreme Court. Now, my wife will probably attest that I'm kind of a dork and a history maniac and political maniac, if anyone was at my last Arctic Entry story. And so I set an alarm clock, and I woke up in the morning to check the SCOTUS blog, the Supreme Court of the United States blog. I was scrolling on my phone, waiting for that SCOTUS blog to update. When the SCOTUS blog came through, it said that DOMA had been overturned, that for the first time in this country, we were making strides towards marriage equality. I remember laying in my bed next to my fiance at the time, now wife, and looking at her and crying and not even imagining that everything in our lives could be real, that for the first time we might have marriage equality, and when we got married, it might be real. And it's this fascinating thing, right? DOMA passes, my phone is ringing, people are calling me, people are texting me. You get on Facebook, it looks like a rainbow just vomited all over everything. Everybody's updating their Facebook status, me included. I'm finding like a photo of me where I hiked flat top with a giant rainbow flag. So I'm standing there with my giant flag of pride. I'm proud of who I am, and I'm proud of what's happening. But I still, just like those refugees have fear, what do I do if I meet a gay person? I also have this fear. What will they think of me if they know I am a gay person? I go to work and I walk into my office and I continue my day as I normally would without saying anything. As I'm walking down the hall to leave my office, I hear a coworker yell, "Hey, yes, so wait a second." I turn around. The person walking towards me is from a country where you are killed for being homosexual if you're caught in the act. He's from a country that has experienced extreme violence for most of his life. He is a Muslim man where his religion doesn't necessarily be open to who I am as a person. He walked down the hall, and as he got closer to me, he reached out his hands in a way that signified he wanted to grab my hand. I held my hand out to him, and I said, "Hey, what's up?" And he grabbed my hand in both hands, and he looked at me in the eye, and he said, "Today is an important day for your family." And I looked at him, as one does when they have no idea what to do. And I was in awe, and I didn't know where this was going necessarily. And he said, "You know, I'm from a place where nothing good ever happened, and the United States let me come here. And they opened this country to me, and I was given equality and freedom. And I've seen what it looks like when someone is told that they don't deserve something because they're different than you. And despite my religion and my culture and all the things that I know, today I'm happy to be your friend. And today your family is equal to my family." And I looked at him and I said, "Thank you." And I walked right out the door and sat down in my car and started to cry. And I sat in that car and I cried, and I didn't cry because he had shocked me with what he said. I didn't cry because he had done something I wasn't expecting. I cried because I realized for the first time in my life as I sat in that car that I had done to him the one thing I didn't want anyone to ever do to me, to judge me for who I was, to look at me by one stereotype and think that they could never understand or be my friend because of who I was. And I had done that to him. And I sat in that car and I cried because I realized that it was an opportunity for me to change that perception. And when I got married to my wife on May 10th, 2014, happy anniversary, I invited my whole staff to that wedding, and we got a card that I could never describe to you what it was. It wasn't tolerance, it was complete acceptance. And so I gave them the opportunity to be I get to participate in the diversity of our office now by showing up every day, by being who I am.
That was Issa Brayman. Well, that's all for this show. Thanks for celebrating 7 years of Arctic Entries with us.
To hear these stories again, or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org. We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers, by the way. Thanks to our audio engineer from the Alaska Teen Media Institute, Kendall Stormo. And thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.